Hey everyone, How Did I Get Here is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and webOS phones. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Hi everyone, this is Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to How Did I Get Here? Before we go into the podcast too much further, let me plug some shows I've got going next week. I will be playing some solo shows the week before Christmas with my friend Joseph King, who's coming in from New York. We will be playing Wednesday, December 21st at Dean's Bar in Houston. It's 316 Main. The show starts at 9 p.m. And then Thursday, December 22nd at Hotel Vegas here in Austin, which is 1500 East 6th Street. That starts at 9 p.m. as well. I don't do a lot of solo shows right now. I haven't so much since about a year ago, and so I'm excited to be doing these. I'm glad Joseph's coming into town. I know we'll be doing a podcast. I think it'll be coming out next week. So I'm looking forward to that. I have not gotten anything for anyone for Christmas yet. So I literally today I'm going to Houston to play a gig, but I have a meeting before I go, and I have to do laundry. So I don't think I'm gonna get too much shopping today. But I will say this. I will do all my shopping in 1 week when I'm going out of town and playing shows and all that kind of stuff. Hopefully between Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday morning, I can do all my shopping. And hopefully you're ahead on your shopping. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-nominated composer P. Kellek Waddle, who also is 19 years he's been the bass player for the Austin Symphony. He is an old friend. I've known him for 20-something years, maybe 23, 24 years. We were trying to figure it out. Probably 23 years, I guess. Next year will be 24 years. I don't know. That's a lot. Almost a quarter of a century. I've always liked Kelly. He's a great guy. He's really out there. He's what I would call wacky, and he's weird and wrong in all my favorite ways. Smart, creative, and interesting, and very honest. So we went to South Congress Cafe here in Austin, and sadly it was so loud when we got there that we ended up having a whole lot of conversation off the record, or OTR as I like to say. So I'm sorry that I missed some of that, but I am glad that we got our conversation down. I was really glad that I got to finally sit down. It's been an elusive one. It's been tough. Both of us have been hard to pin down. Both of us have had a lot going on. And so anyway, he does a lot of stuff. I wish I could tell you everything he does, but he's an incredibly prolific composer. He is a very busy player with the Austin Symphony. He's got an incredible story. So here's my friend, P. Kellek Waddle.
Thank you. say, all those people are going to go back there and go, the dude with eight juices, because he must have just got out of rehab or something. Yeah, that's what he always think about, because rehab people always have to eat all that C all at the same time.
He's with one guy just drinking like by himself Bloody Marys, and this guy's got like literally 18 grapefruit juices in front of him. So,
alrighty.
Kelly Waddle. I'm here with my friend Kelly Waddle. He's a composer, a conductor, and a bass.
A solo bassist.
Solo bassist.
And an orchestra bassist.
And an orchestra bassist.
And a car dealer and a game designer.
Yeah, let's talk
and
about,
a
let's
writer.
Talk about the car dealing. let's talk about the car dealing really fast.
The short version is that I actually haven't been so busy. I haven't gotten to do this in about a year, a little bit more than a year. I hope to get back into it in February. But no, I still am on staff at a place that does private casinos for parties and stuff.
Right.
That there is no literal money exchanged hands, but they are... all use as their trainers people who have worked in either Vegas or Atlantic City, so you literally are trained through almost as rigorously as if you were going to be a dealer in an actual casino.
Okay.
The only difference is we're not taught all kinds of fancy shuffling, but in terms of that we literally have to learn how to move your hands as if there was a camera. That even though there aren't cameras, because these casinos are kind of just put together in certain venues.
Right.
But you are
it's
trained.
Like the eye in the sky.
Exactly, but you are trained what to do. This is what you do, how you're supposed to move your hands if there is a camera. So, and it's helped my gambling a great deal.
are you a big gambler?
Oh, yeah.
Now, does that go with, like, what? See, I live in a world of rock and roll, and like there's some country guys every
uh-huh.
now and then, right? Maybe a jazz guy here and there, but they don't really hang out so much with us. But in the world of classical music, I mean, are you guys also degenerates?
Well, I've got to say, so far, that's the best question I've been asked in an interview in a year. Are you people also degenerates? In a word, yes.
I have hung out with you in the middle of the night. I have hung out with you in the middle of the night and gone to your house and had mead.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know you like a late night
Yes, in a different sort of kind of degeneracy, you could say, but yeah. Much more than people who would go watch an orchestra performance and say it's a bunch of boring people in tuxedos. Now, granted, a lot of that stereotype does hold. There are a lot of rather boring,
right.
colorless people.
Right.
But much less than, let's say, the novice classical music attender would think.
Right. Well, let me... We'll start with this piece. You sent me some music today to listen to.
Yes, sir.
This stuff is hard to find on the internet, like not like a pop or rock and musician. And so you sent me some pieces, a couple of short pieces, but then you sent me a longer piece that's American Nightmare something.
Okay, the string quartet. I thought we were talking about the orchestra piece earlier. No, that's the string quartet, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When did you write that piece?
I wrote that piece in late 2007 into 2008. I was unbelievably blessed. It was a huge leap in my exposure and fame and such. The world-renowned and unbelievable Moreau Quartet is now the... for the past handful of years has been the resident string quartet in the UT School of Music. They had heard a piece of mine that I had written two of their students. A piece I was very proud of, but if someone had told me, this is your piece auditioning to see if they'll pay you to write them something, I would have picked something else.
Right.
And I got this random phone call about 2.5 months after that piece going, this is the cellist of the Moreau Quartet. We are very interested. Moreau.
And who are they?
Well, like I said, they're the resident quartet now at UT School of Music.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And they teach
and
in
they
the
call
department.
You.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they said, we're very interested in having a chat with you to commission you to write us a new quartet. And I listened to the voicemail like 3 times. When I realized I couldn't call them back yet because I'm supposed to be cool and stuff, and I was like all jumping up and down and screaming and calling my publisher and my mother at the same time. Then I was all cool, and I was like, then I answered them and said, yes, I think that's a wonderful idea, blah, blah. And again, talking about removing the dogma or whatever, this is one of the most famous quartets now in the world of quartets made up of people under the age of 45. And we just drank coffee and I smoked cigarettes at Flipnotics, and they asked me what kind of piece I'd like to write them. I mean, it was because they live right there, and it was just, you know, there was no, you know, huge like coronation or something,
right,
you know.
Right. Well, what was the inspiration for the piece? Because by the title, obviously, there were two wars going on at the time that you, I mean, were these reflections of sort of.
No, they're not necessarily the wars. What they were reflections of is my reaction to the right wing. And I'm glad you asked me that, because the reason they asked me is during that year, they were doing this set of concerts that was split called the Light Side of America and the Dark Side of America. They were doing standard pieces, pieces that were rather renowned on each concert. And each set of light and dark,
yeah.
They're also commissioning a new piece for each side.
Okay.
So they got a rather renowned composer who used to teach at UT named Kevin Putz to write them a new quartet for the light side.
Okay.
And they specifically told me, this is the idea. How do you want to approach this? They wanted a quartet for the dark side. And I had never yet in my lifetime written a piece with any sort of political bent. Everything I write is about, you know, like weather or dreams or angels or things I see out the window or whatever. I had never written a piece as any sort of stand. But as the right wing has taken so much hold in the past 30 years in this country, at the speech I gave at this premiere, which is still, it's on the internet, I basically said, starting at the rise of Ronald Reagan,
right.
As a incredibly devout but incredibly left-wing Christian, and as somebody who always thought I was patriotic until I saw a lot of things that have happened in the last 30 years, what the word patriot and what the word Christian means now to most people
is not what you identify
exactly
with.
Is all
but you identify yourself as both a Christian and a patriot.
Exactly.
Okay,
I've always been very hurt and very offended by that, especially if you live in Texas, especially when you're originally from a hillbilly state.
Yeah.
That if you tell somebody, if I look somebody in the eye and tell them I'm a Christian or a patriot, you suddenly have to qualify all of that. No, I'm not a nut job. No, I'm not, I don't think the world is coming to an end because we don't pray in school.
Right.
So it was really ironic that when they said that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take all of that and write a piece about that. And that way, if you listen to that.
There's America theme.
America and God Bless America,
right, God Bless America, right.
And Amazing Grace and Rock of Ages
right.
are all rather ugly warped in this
great
big mosaic. Yeah. That's another thing about the form of that piece. Most pieces that are more than 20 minutes, I usually have written sketches
and
for ages.
This is 28 minutes.
So yeah, it's about 28 minutes. I usually write all the sketches, and when I start jigsaw puzzling it together, usually it's very much point A to point B to point C to point D.
Right.
The other different thing about that piece is that it's kind of a mosaic.
Yeah, that's what it felt like.
But it
felt like a very angry. It really felt like you could sense the disillusionment. You know what I mean? And you could sense. I'm telling you on one listen, and just kind of seeing
you.
The name of it.
I'm very glad that gets across.
At least I saw the name of it. I don't know if I would have heard disillusionment if I didn't know the name of it,
uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? But I would have heard those songs and then seen like the first few notes of the melody are the same, and then all of a sudden it takes this very freaky turn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got that. And I'm really glad that I got to hear that, because I really got a good sense of your ability to express that.
Thank you, because I really appreciate it. And also, not all of my pieces aren't important to me in some way.
Of course.
But they were paying me for, especially that time, a fairly gargantuan amount of money for a poor musician.
Right.
These people are, they aren't the first world famous people I've written a piece for, but still, when you write a piece for world famous people, it's a bit different than a piece you're going to write to play at a bar tomorrow, I'm making a political statement, I'm forming it different, it's for famous people. There was a lot of more trepidation as I was writing that piece than there was for some other pieces. And I talked to a lot of composers, a lot more famous than me, that I have been very blessed that consider me their colleague, as I was writing that piece, and like, Kelly, if they didn't like your stuff and want you to write a piece that's you, they wouldn't have asked you. Don't think any different about how you compose and how you're putting this down on the paper than you did, like, if you're writing a piece to play at somebody's wedding next week.
Right.
So that was really helpful, that it pulled that sort of a little bit of worry away, and I just wrote. And they were very happy about the statement it made, and they were also very happy that I am very blessed that I can write really, really fast, and I don't like being late, and I don't like being under more pressure than I am already. I got that piece done a year and 2 months before the deadline.
Oh, so how long what did they give you to write it? 2 years?
Almost 2 years, yeah.
Okay, because I was going to say, like, how long, and so you wrote it in under a year?
3 months.
3 months.
Because, I was still writing
it's
about...
It's an incredibly complex piece.
Well,
obviously that's a lot faster, but is the deadline that they gave you a more realistic sort of parameters that you work in with a long piece like that? I mean, do you set out to write a 28-minute piece, or do you just set out to write and then it takes you somewhere?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, they said, we want a piece of X breadth. You know, don't write 3 hours, but we're not paying you to write 2 minutes either.
Right.
So when I sort of formulated it all and I knew what the other pieces on the concert were, I was like, you know, between 20 and 30 minutes, I think it's going to be, there it is.
Right.
Especially since also, you know, most a lot of pieces of that length are multiple movements.
Right.
Especially since I knew that piece was going to be one movement.
Right.
I don't mean to badmouth anybody, but no, them and certain other famous groups have told me that on the way to premieres in planes, they've had composers text them and say, oh, the changes are going to be in your hotel room when you get there.
Right.
And there are a lot more people who work like that than do what I do.
Right.
But I'm very blessed to have everything going I do. But, you know, I have enough stress and concerns as it is. All working like that to me just adds more stress. So I'm all about, this needs to be done way before the deadline. And also, too, another very important thing, shout out to my publisher, a man who runs the company that published my music, Thomas Dawkins, who I love very, very dearly. It's a very small company. It's not 50 engravers. It's one or two. So the quicker I can get something of that magnitude done, the less he's freaked out.
Right.
So
and so does that work come through your management or through your publishers or?
Oh, you mean that's the publisher? That's just the I basically send him the copied over pencil version, and then they make it as say quote unquote look like that music that you buy in the store.
Right. And can you buy your music like sheet music?
Oh yeah.
Oh really?
Oh yeah, almost.
I'm so impressed.
Almost. I mean, a lot of it is in different venues and different ways to get it. I'm trying to get it all sort of unified now. But no, I have almost, I think, 250 pieces that you can buy now.
Wow, that's amazing.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go back.
Okay.
You say you're a hillbilly. So where are you from? Where is this hillbilly?
I am actually from the city, but my parents grew up in the southern hills of Kentucky, and Louisville, Kentucky, as long as I have lived in Texas, which I've lived in Texas now longer than I lived in Louisville, Kentucky in many ways will still always be, air quotes, will be home.
Okay. So were there musicians in your family, or were they classical music enthusiasts?
There was always lots of music around.
But it wasn't.
No, there was a lot of, you're going to do what?
Yeah.
Not that they were enormously supportive, but the short version of how I, well, I was going to say, isn't that the title of this show? How did I get
here?
Anyway, when I was tested as a toddler and found to be some sort of alleged freak genius person, they found out I could read at 19 months, I was doing math at 2, I started writing little stories on a typewriter at 3. And both my parents, my father's now deceased, but both my parents were incredibly intelligent people and the first people in their family to go to college.
Okay. And what did they do? What did your dad do?
My father did all kinds of things. My father's degrees were in math.
Okay.
But he was in high-level business management for most of my life and his life. And then, ironically...
So that was a smart road to take or something, right?
Yes,
right?
Uh-huh.
That was a safe way.
Oh, yeah, completely. And my mother...
Are you an only child?
Do you not see the siren?
No. I was just asking for the people.
No, I know. I was going to say no. I literally think only children are like, you know, aliens. Because, you know, there's a siren. We can tell. It's like,
you're an
only child.
Yeah.
But so, as part of... This is one of the things you do if you have smart little kid.
Yeah.
You give them music lessons.
Okay.
So my dad, ironically, to be the person who, not in his own way, he was incredibly supportive and always was, but also one of the people that there was the most knockdown dragouts of, oh my God, you're going to try to do what for a living?
Yeah, yeah.
That he was the one who said, here, we're going to take music lessons. And I was like 8. And I took lessons on, like, multiple instruments until I was 17 and a half.
So what were the instruments?
Started on violin.
Okay.
So my violin, it's really strange. When I still think of string music in my head, I feel the violin fingerings more than I feel the bass fingerings in my head. It's really weird. I think it's because the first thing I related to.
Do you still play? I mean, do you have, like, a violin, a cello?
No, I just know. I have bass and a piano, and I have other basses and a viola. I still have a viola because it's my other... I gave up everything and decided bass and viola were the main things at 18. Then at about 23, I get on my viola about once a year and play like 2 hours of Bach and an hour of scales to make sure I knew how it works. But
once a year.
Yeah,
sorry.
No.
What am I doing?
I know. That's
sorry. It's alcohol.
It's because I haven't had a drink. Yeah. But anywho, so then, you know, when you have a child of that alleged off the charts intelligence, and you both grew up, I mean, my father was kind of poor, my mother wasn't poor, my grandparents were very upper middle class,
right?
But and had a huge farm, and he got all this stuff going on when he came back from World War II,
right?
But they still lived, you know, in the hills,
right? So did he go to was he like in Vietnam or something?
My dad was in Gulf War I because he was serving. He was full time. Thank you. Before I was born, and then he was reserved till he retired.
Okay.
And he was a radio person. And Gulf War I, they took the doctors and the radio people first out of the reserves.
Oh wow!
So my second year at Rice, where I knew you then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's this weird thing, thinking if there's ever a war, well, are we going to have to go? No, my dad went. That's...
Were they old parents or were they young parents, younger parents?
My parents, they were old for Kentucky.
Well.
But no, they were, I think they were no age when I was born. My dad was 28, my mom was 25.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have, you know, lots of people their age... Some in our family, but lots of people we know are like great-grandparents by now. So some stereotypes hold, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. But anyway, the rest of to complete that thought for you is that about the going to be a musician, when you have that alleged level of off-the-charts intelligence at that level, and you've come from this background, naturally your parents are thinking rocket scientist, Harvard Law Review at 19, you know... You're going to discover the cure for cancer. blah, 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 blah. And when you start telling them at basically puberty...
I like bass.
Really, at puberty age, I'm going to be a musician for a living.
Yeah.
There's just this... What?
So you guys have the same... Well, I mean, I wasn't of any... probably of no intelligence, but when I went to... you know, my mom was very supportive of my music and stuff like that, but my dad was very discouraging. But whatever. I think they probably saw the same thing that probably your parents did, was like, there's so many easier ways.
Oh, completely.
To get through life than doing what.
Oh,
it is
God
that we
Almighty,
do.
Yes, and you know. Especially when I talk to composition departments, every time I'm on tour at universities, the first thing I do when I open my mouth is I say, ladies and gentlemen, and they all say, and they read my mini bio, and everybody claps and says, I'm usually either playing a concert there or have a piece being there tomorrow, and today he's giving us a talk, and blah, blah, blah. The minute the applause dies or whatever, I look everybody in the eye and I go, first thing I'm here to tell you is something that probably a teacher is never going to tell you. If there is anything you can do besides being a classical music composer that you think can remotely make you happy or fulfill your life, save your trouble and go do it now.
Yeah.
And you know, there's these tears and this horror, yeah, and people going pale and whatever, and I'm like, because, I mean... Or musician of any sort, or class musician of any sort, basically to pursue anything in the arts in this culture.
Right.
It's too hard, you're going to be too poor for too long. Even when you do get modicums of success, you have different levels of crap you have to deal with. Exactly. So I feel like, well, if I can tell you this when you're 20, if you're wavering, save the trouble. And then I kind of lighten up or whatever, but you know, I mean, no one tells people that. And I feel like if these schools are nice enough to play my music or have me there and think I have something remotely of any wisdom to impart,
yeah,
well then I kind of feel like I don't have the conscience to not tell them that.
Right.
You know, not that every day, every once in a while, you don't have a day that sucks and go, boy, I wish I was a doctor or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's just normal. It's any career.
Yeah. But I'm sure there are days when my friends that I grew up with that grew up to have normal jobs and live normal lives, you know, quote unquote normal. I mean, you know, now even, I mean, I'm in a cover band, and it's interesting because all those things that, you know, my dad might have said then, he doesn't really say anymore when I talk to him, because my friends that worked at Enron and looked like they had a fucking future at one point. I mean, I'm friends with, you know, it's all relative like that. So,
yeah.
Let's go back. So, you played violin.
Yeah, I took violin, viola, bass, piano, and voice lessons till I was 17 and a half.
And at any time during that time, did you have any other ideas of something you would want to be? Like, at no point did the boy want to be a fireman?
No. There was a brief thought of being a lawyer.
What kind of law? Do you know? Just
like a criminal.
Yeah. It goes back to the 48 hours.
It goes back to, like, I want to be paid to do lots of research, because I was such a, like, still a humongous book and information addict. So the idea of, like, I have to read all these, like, 5,000 pages of books so I can go argue with somebody. Show how, like, you know, not your normal 8-year-old.
Right.
I thought that sounded fun. But it... And then, because I still write and do some now, the other thing was to write full time, like word write and all my journalism work. And, you know, the funny thing is that, once again, my father, God rest his soul, would be like, how come none of your even possible alternatives are any more, like, stable than what you're going to do anyway?
Yeah.
How come, like, you know, if we had kind of forced it, how come, like, I'm either going to do this, or maybe I'll be a computer programmer, or, like, I'm going to do this, or maybe I'm going to be a stockbroker. You know, I mean, not that they're doing that great. But,
yeah, those
guys
are jumping out of windows. So, and this was in Kentucky?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you got to 17, you started like, looking into colleges. Obviously, you're probably looking into colleges. The colleges might have been looking at you. Were there? Sorry, I don't mean to take you.
No.
Don't worry about
that. No, please.
Yeah. And if you need to stop for any reason, just tell me.
Oh, no. Both, because one of the other pluses of knowing what you're
going to do. I mean, were you like the smartest person in Kentucky? I mean, not to doubt anybody in Kentucky, but you know what I mean. Like,
well,
I mean,
there,
it's a small
I was very
that
blessed
point.
That even in a state not necessarily known for education, from the third grade on, we had a big deal of advanced and gifted and talented people, and they put 9-year-olds in college classes and stuff. And then from the eighth grade on, I was in an arts magnet school, and I got my first orchestra job when I was 17. So I was sort of, all my life, so to speak, I was already kind of doing what I do.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, you may go to like camps and read books and stuff, but you know, you're not operating on people and diagnosing people in high school if you're going to be a doctor someday. Yeah. But you know, I was already doing what I do.
Right.
So.
As was I at that age as well.
Exactly, like, you sure
like,
were,
like
yes.
You just kind of like, you're doing it. You're there.
And you know, and especially since I went to an arts magnet school, we were always running an opera. We always had freelance gigs we had to play. We had the stuff we were playing for school. We had classes we were taking. All the lessons we took on stuff. I mean, it was sort of like, it was one really wonderful thing about being in a magnet school of that kind of heated, constant duty was I understandably watched a lot of people say, I don't want to live like this. Because when I'm 25, I'll live like this and I won't be at home with my mom paying for the food. Like, because this is, it's like, this is what life is like if you're going to do this.
Like, yeah, like if you see the movie Fame, that's a magnet school. They put you through the fucking ropes. You wouldn't believe how much quieter this restaurant is now.
I just
noticed it. I was like, wow, I can really hear Kelly.
Yeah.
So at the end of the magnet school, then what did you do?
Well, the ironic thing is that I was, in a lot of ways, I was very cosmopolitan, 18-and-a-half-year-old. In a lot of ways, I was drastically immature. So I wouldn't leave home yet, so I went to the University of Louisville, basically, as a stopgap. I had a lot of, some nice musical things happen there, but it was a big mess. I knew I didn't really want to go to school there. A lot of good things about their music school, a lot of an enormous amount of bullshit about their music school. And it was just kind of a year, sort of a wash. And in that year is when I planned, where am I really going to go to school? And after fielding lots of offers, I then the next year went to Cincinnati Conservatory, where I had thought I was going to stay. And then as things like this progress, if there's a commercial, it would happen right here, because then people go, well, then how did you get to Texas? But yeah. So
what was happening in Cincinnati that let you down at the conservatory there?
Oh, it was not. It was the inverse. I adored living in Cincinnati. You know, there's always some sort of romance about the first place you live away from home, even if it was 85 miles up the road.
Yeah.
Cool apartment.
That's true.
I had this cool apartment. I lived by these cool bars.
Yeah.
The whole street was other conservatory pals.
Yeah.
There was this, you know, it's one of the most famous music schools in the world. It was this amazing orchestra. People were really cool to me. I got to skip an enormous amount of undergrad stuff from testing out of it, and I was taking grad school level theory in music history because at 19, which is really fun, and I wrote 2 papers for those classes that actually got published. It was, you know, no, there was
you
nothing.
You know what? Something just dawned on me. You're not gambling when you're gambling. Like, you might be too smart to be fucking straight up gambling, and I hope there's no gambling people listening.
That's interesting thing to say.
Are you like counting cards?
No, I was about to say, I'm not counting cards. I'm doing all the things that I've learned that the gamblers for a living legally do. But no, I can't count cards.
Let's go back to Cincinnati.
I kind of keep a general idea. But no, trust me, if I could count cards, I wouldn't be playing like 6 hours of $3. I'd be playing like 2 hours of $500 and just
say,
get up and leave.
Yeah.
No. Anyway. No.
Okay, so
Cincinnati was a phenomenal place, and then I got into a music festival that was in Austria the summer after I went to Cincinnati for a year and a half. And I was offered a sort of full-time job in the valley to teach at 2 little bitty Texas schools, colleges, and to play in 2 half to 2/3 time orchestras. Knowing how hard it is to
be the Valley of Texas?
Yes.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Corpus Christi Symphony and Victoria Symphony, and knowing how hard it is to get a job. Even though I wasn't a quarter done with my degrees, Oh, I'd gotten a minor that year. I'd gotten two minors that year, but I didn't get, I mean, I didn't have a bachelor's yet. And they said, are you the conductor of this festival? The person who ran those jobs. So, you know, once again, this is 1987, people, so there was no email or cell phone.
No. Well, I mean, there was cell phone, but people like us didn't have
one. No. James Bond had one. Yeah. I sent my mother the I'm leaving school version of the Dear John letter.
Yeah.
I'm leaving school for at least a year and a half, take these jobs to move to South Texas.
Because they need me in the valley. They're like underprivileged Mexican kids that need to learn viola. What were you thinking?
It was a job, and it was kind of like what we talked about before we started earlier. It was like, I'm 19 years old, I only have a degree, and someone's like, here's a job.
Yeah. It's fucking
awesome.
Well,
damn, I better take it.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to eventually end back up at Rice. At that time, I was thinking I'd go to Rice to go to grad school. But I did think this out. I'm like, I'm not very far from Houston. I can take lessons from the Rice teacher. I'll do all this way instead. Well, needless to say, because he thought I would never go back. a very unfounded fear, since I ended up with 7 degrees. But my father went into hysteria because he thought I would never go back to school. My mother was just kind of confused, but she was very supportive and understood. Maybe Kel's right. Maybe if someone offers you this and you're just barely 20 years old and... you don't even have your degrees yet. Jobs are really hard to come by in what he does. Maybe he's right to go do this. And so I did that for a year and a half. And then I thankfully got into, my plan worked. I got into Rice. And then I finished 2 bachelors and another minor at Rice.
I met you. That's where I met you.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
You were the roommate of my friend, Paul Lewin, that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was a misjudgment when we got back in touch with each other. I remember seeing your name on a thing, and I was like, I remember that guy. Like, I was, you know, I always thought you were weird as shit, but like the kind of weird that I like.
That
you
was
know what
impetus
I mean?
From not you. That was impetus from other people's
no,
names.
No, I totally understand. I totally understand. I wrote you this email, and I guess these people treated you like shit. At some point, but I was not among them because I was astonished that your reaction was such because. I always liked you. And I remember, I'll be honest, I remember seeing you through the 90s living here, like crossing a street downtown, and I would be with my ex-wife, and I'd be like, I know that guy, it's Kelly Watt. We used to live with Paul Ware.
That's really, really nice. No, and also, the reason I qualify that, about that not had to do with you, let me explain something about Rice.
Okay.
As much as I was very... blessed to go there because my teacher there was one of the most famous, and still is one of the most famous space teachers in the world.
Right.
To be a strange, long-haired, weird little musician, genius person who still has a lot of mental health battles to conquer and was probably taking a few too many pills at the time, to be that kind of person in the middle of 1600 SAT engineering dorks who had never left home yet when I had already kind of lived for 2.5 years. I still have an enormous amount of friends that mean a great deal to me from there, but I was very out of place.
That's what I liked about you.
Oh, thank you. And see, I appreciate that. And then, you know, a lot of the people who compounded that out of placeness for me. Not that in my own admittance and their defense that at times my behavior didn't warrant it.
Sure.
But then like, it was like, oh, Johnny Galli's like amazingly talented and famous, but he was friends with all those people who made me more of an outcast than I already was. But you know what? Now here we are.
Look who's laughing now. So you did your time at Rice, and then when you graduated where did you go?
That's another interesting thing. This is the part. This is the part of the story that pretty much the one I tell all the time.
Okay.
At that time, I hated Houston. I hated Texas. I hated the weather. I hated the people. Still don't like Houston. It's like, get me out of here. Get me out of here. I had everything, including a assistantship offer to work with a very famous composer. I had a plane ticket to go find a New Haven apartment. I had everything for a deal at grad school at Yale, all but in blood. And woman in my life at that time said,
Jesus.
No, it's kind of an interesting, because trust me, as soon as someone says it, I'm like, hey, here's what I'll get fucked up in, she said, you know what, Austin Symphony has two bass openings, you should maybe take the audition just for shits and giggles. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's a chance to go to Austin, because, you know, as much as a hellhole Houston was, every time we'd come here, I had a phenomenal time. You always see people, you know, always have a good time. I had a fair amount of friends here, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, yeah, I think, yeah, why did I go? So I practiced real hard, and there were two spots. One was tenure track. One was a one-year spot.
Wait, what was the other one? Tenure track?
One is a tenure track, one was a one-year spot.
Okay. So tell me the difference between that, because I bet a lot of people that are listening to those are going to be why. Obviously, I understand one of them, you're going to be there forever, and the other one
exactly.
is an
orchestra seating and in orchestra contracts, so a lot of times they're just hiring either for a phantom spot or to quote-unquote test you, and they'll just give you a year spot. If they believe, if after an audition you're picked and they believe in you, they'll put you on tenure track.
Okay. So you went to
so
the audition.
I went to the audition and putting my stuff away, they're like, okay, we do need to hear four more people for a third round. And I'm like, okay, whatever.
You like know. A callback?
And I'm putting my stuff, I put my bass back, and I'm getting ready to go smoke a cigarette, and whatever. And they said, these four people are for the one-year job, because we already know that right now we're giving the tenure track position to candidate number 9, which seems to be Mr. Wad. And I was like, huh?
Here you were just trying to get away for a weekend.
What?
And you got tenure.
I was like, what
That's
the fuck
amazing.
Do I do now?
Wow.
And to go again about the story of how I moved to Texas, especially in this horrible day and age of orchestras folding right and left and how hard it is to get an orchestra job of any sort, even one that may not pay jack.
Now or then?
Both, but especially
okay.
now.
Especially now, yeah.
You know, you don't turn your nose up at someone winning a tenure track orchestra job in a city this cool, in a city where it's this relatively cheap to live in. You don't say, you know. So, the first chair bass, who was my teacher and colleague and still is, was my teacher in grad school, goes, don't sign the last thing about you. He said, tell me the numbers. So I said, here's what Yale's offering. He goes, give me 3 days to get you a better deal to come to grad school at UT, and you'll be my assistant and take this job. I'm like, okay. Well, it didn't take him 3 days. It was 36 hours. They gave me, had to do a whole lot of crap at UT for 3 years for this, but they gave me a phenomenal better deal than UT did. As badly as I wanted out of Texas, and as illustrious as a Yale degree is, everyone knows that New Haven is a hellhole.
Yeah.
Whereas Austin is Austin.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I said yes, and I pick up the telephone and I call the Yale grad school representative, who was like my liaison, who gave me all the, here's your official offer. I was like,
right.
I'm not coming. Oh, are you not coming this week? Or did something come up? You're not coming to find your apartment like on Thursday? So
I'm
like,
I'm not coming.
No, I'm not. I'm not coming. And they're like, oh, did we offend you? Do you want blah, 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 blah? And I told them the whole story. And they're like, we can't compete with those numbers, but I'll call you back in an hour. And they call back an hour. It's like, we can't compete with those numbers that UT's giving you, and you have a tenure track orchestra job waiting for you. So
what are you going to do?
We are very disappointed, but God bless you and good luck. And that was early August 1992. And to get to the name of our show, folks, that's how I got here.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Here we are. So since
and
then,
it's very surreal to know that next summer that will be 20 effing years. That
wow.
is absolutely still to me unthinkable.
So you've been with the Austin Symphony for 20 years.
Next year.
Mm-hmm.
19 and a half.
So what what does that entail? Like, what do you guys do? Like, you guys rehearse every day? Do you rehearse every couple of days? Do you rehearse once a week? Do you rehearse when you have shows? Do you... You get blowjobs after gigs? I'm just kidding. I'm sorry.
I must be hanging out with the wrong after symphony people. Anyway, no, we have X set of rehearsals, what's called per sequence.
Okay.
That, like,
there's a season, right?
Yes. Okay. But it's not every day. Sometimes it's 12 days a month. Sometimes it's 2 days a month. Sometimes it's 20 days a month. It's, you know, it shows that very incredibly happy and blessed and proud to have been a symphony member for 20 years. But it is not the stability of being in a quote-unquote full-time orchestra. However, let me point out, if I had a full-time orchestra job that where I might be a whole lot more financially stable, but if I had to play 29 days a month, 11 months out of the year, I would not get to do a lot of the tons of other things I'm blessed to get to do. So there's a balance there. You're like, damn, we don't get a paycheck this month. I mean, oh well, but you can do this.
Right. So what you obviously you compose.
Mm-hmm.
You go and you speak.
Yeah.
And you present your pieces.
Uh-huh. And I do solo recital tours.
Solo recital tours. What is that like? You just jump in the car with your bass and just
pretty much. Yeah. Here's an interesting thing for what I think is probably until my publicity people start shoving the link of this all over creation when you're ready.
Right.
What most of your listener base may think, is it any different really than what y'all do?
Right. Nope. Right. But that's what I wanted to see.
It's like, here's 9 recitals, some at schools, some on music festivals, some at like little art centers, and plus a bass in the car, clothes in the car, blah, blah, blah. Thankfully, thank God, in the past 3 years or so, I usually can pay one of my people that works with me and helps me out, hey, can you take 2 weeks off work if I give you this much money to help me drive around and crap? And then
so you have roadies?
They're sort of all purpose. They're roadies. There, can you help drive some? There, can you call blah blah and tell them I can't answer this email till we get 100 miles from here? There, So,
wow.
I got peeps.
Yeah, that's good. You need peeps.
Hired a new one last week.
Nice.
There you go, bro. There's your shout out. I knew you were gonna like listen to this. Going, are you gonna say my name? No.
What's his name?
Chase. What's up, dude? Yeah, it's up.
Chase.
Yeah, and because Blake, who is one of my other dudes, he has a very, very busy other set of stuff that he is on the road for his other job all the time. So he does an enormous amount of stuff for me, like remote. Like, he helps run, like, edit some stuff, and he runs a mailing list, and he does all kinds of computer stuff for me.
Right. Well, let's talk about all the interesting things that you do. Are you affiliated through that? There's a place in Austin, if you're not from Austin or not in Austin listening to this, there's a place called Alamo Draft House. It's a place where you can go and you can eat and drink and stuff. And those are friends of yours from college, or you just do stuff for them sometimes. Don't you present?
Tim League lived in the room under the people you used to go visit.
Okay.
That's where that started.
Oh, okay. But I have seen that you do concerts with movies.
Yeah, it's one of our PK Productions right now. My concert promotion series sort of has 4 umbrellas.
Okay.
One of them is we do concerts with movies at Alamo Draft House.
Let's talk about that because I think that's a pretty fucking interesting thing. It's a good way for people that are not exposed to this kind of music, classical music. A way for them to get into it in a normal, you know what I mean? Like they can watch
completely.
A movie.
That was the whole point of why I started it.
Okay, good.
Was that you can, when they wrote the Austin Monthly article about me in December 2006, that was what they focused on. I think something, I can't remember right now, but I think the headline was classical music to the masses.
Yeah.
But that we have a movie. We play about 20 minutes before the movie starts. Anything from stuff that's inspired by the movie and or music from the movie, and also I and some of my colleagues write new pieces about something that has to do with the movie.
Yeah.
Then we split the movie into 2/3 and 1/3. At 2/3, we stop the movie and we have a 15-minute intermission, and I give away stuff, and we have I give away DVDs. We have a trivia contest. We have one more little concert, and then we watch the rest of the movie.
Okay, so before we get too far on this, anyone who's listening to that is like, oh shit, that's something I'd be interested in. How does someone follow you? What's your website?
If you Facebook me and or look up P. Califwaddle on anywhere on the internet, any of my propaganda will have my main email address. And all you do is click my main email address and say, put me on your mailing list.
Okay. Perfect.
Right. Or in somebody who has to be mentioned frequently today, otherwise he'll be very sad and angry, understandably, because he is indispensable to running the engine of my career, is my brother David Wyatt, who runs Wyatt Brand Publicity, who does all my publicity.
Oh, cool. So,
could always go through them, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wyatt?
Wyatt Brand, W-A-T-T Brand, yes.
Okay, so you do the movies, and then what's the second?
Other series, what we just did, the first one of this year. Years before I knew I was going to be able to be blessed enough to run anything under my name. Actually, when I was 16 years old, being the avid to borderline pathological wordophile and bibliophile I was, I wrote in a sketchbook when I was 16 years old the idea of to do concerts about books.
Wow.
And now, many years later, one of our other series we do, have been done for the past 5 years, is called A Synthesis of Music and Literature, where I pick either one author or books on a certain theme.
Right.
I give 10 to 15 minute overviews and talks about the books, with the point of the talks that these books are too heavy. I don't want to read this shit for fun. I had to read this in school. Right. My whole point is, well, maybe I can take away the horror and show you, you can read this for fun.
Yeah.
And then we play new pieces I wrote about the books.
Wow.
So that series, ironically, because of its venue and because of certain situations, I'm going to start selling more advertising the programs. That series makes us, meaning PK Productions, zero money, and I got thousands of dollars in the hole at every event.
Yeah.
But because it's something that's meant something to me for like 3/4 of my life,
right,
it means a great deal to me. So, so there's that one.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other third series under PK Productions umbrella is The Instrument, in parentheses, according to PKW, which is a series I run 3 or 4 concerts a year, where we do music I have all music I have written for either one instrument or one set of instruments. This past season did a whole concert of my flute music. It was The Flute According to PKW. Last November did all a concert of my bass and harp music. The bass sound of a bass and a harp, according to PKW. And this year, there will be the sound of a bass and cello, according to PKW. 12 of my bass and cello pieces. And hopefully, if we can get it all situated, it may have to wait to the beginning of next season. The sound of the piano, volume 1, according to PKW. So that's another thing I really like a lot, that I can say, here's new pieces, and maybe some pieces I wrote 20 years ago, for one instrument and one set of people, and here's my perspective on that instrument as my career evolved. So.
Right.
And then the fourth series is sort of just ad hoc, either quote-unquote normal chamber music, or normal meaning not as perhaps
avant-garde.
Unique of these other things I'm doing, or avant-garde. I hate to say avant-garde, though, because
I like it's still like 70s.
I know, but
60s.
For the uninitiated, it means they're going to think my music sounds like, you know, squeaking and blinking and whatever.
Right, and they're just robots.
No, avant-garde in terms of the idea, not in terms of the material.
Okay.
But like the first concert we did this year was I played Hour of Bach. I mean, that was, you know, it didn't really fit in those other categories, but that was the first PK Productions event this year. It's easy to kind of situate because it was just me.
Yeah.
We had a very low budget. So.
And so you also said that you're doing some things at the Whip Inn. Is that like a regular thing?
I have just started this because my buddy Steve Bernal, who has been
good buddy of mine,
much more, has spent a lot more time trying to break barriers than I have, and spent a lot more time doing that in terms of between the quote-unquote, I hate these adjectives, but these are the only ones we got, between the quote-unquote classical legit people and the quote-unquote club people. I mean, again,
right.
I despise those adjectives, but they're the only ones to sort of communicate what I'm talking about.
Right.
And he just started playing solo Bach or solo cello pieces of whatever you want at Whip Inn for Saturday brunch. I had actually asked him, I was like, brother, I don't mean to horn in on your gig or something, but since I'm practicing so much Bach lately, can I sit in for like a tune or two just to practice it in a non-normal venue? And he was actually kind of thrilled and said, no, how about instead, every time you can and you're not already busy, you share this gig with me. I was like, that's really cool. He said, I'm not trying to horn in on your gig. But it's like, no.
It'd be nice to hear both of you guys play together.
So now every Saturday that I can at the famous Whip Inn, which is a really cool thing.
In Austin.
It's an Indian restaurant and a convenience store and a fancy place to sit. By the way, I just want to say the reason that that means so much to me is that there's members of my family who own a sort of country version of that.
Oh, really?
Who run it. They're like, it's a store, and it's a sporting goods store, and they got tobacco, and they got a place to sit and eat, and they got... So, anyway, you know, that's always kind of stuck out to me. It's like, oh, this is like my uncle's store. Anyway, now, 12:30 to 2, that's actually one of the last things I'll be playing in 2011. Before 2012 starts. Depending on when this is posted.
It'll be tomorrow.
Okay. Saturday, December the 17th? Is Saturday the 17th?
I think so. What do you have coming up in the new year? Do you have any movies at the Alamo?
We haven't got to talk about dates yet, but somewhere in the late winter and spring, first two movies of the year, do Amadeus, which is sort of our flagship thing, and Immortal Beloved, right around the 175th anniversary of Beethoven's death.
Awesome.
And then something I'm going to talk to them about is looking throughout the year that, you know, for those of you who are also big movie people like I am, Ken Russell just died. You know, very famous avant-garde director. He made an enormous amount of movies about composers. Now, they certainly aren't as mainstream as Amadeus and Immortal Beloved are, but they're incredibly interesting. They would make incredible shows.
Amadeus, did he? That was me.
No, that's Milos Forman. Yeah. But Ken Russell has made movies. One movie we have done in our Alamo Music and a Movie series is this incredibly freaky movie about Tchaikovsky called The Music Lovers. Mm-hmm. He's also made a movie about Mahler. He made a movie about Elgar. He made a movie about Delius. So I'm in the process of starting some emails to talk to the Alamo booking people to see if they're interested in looking at Ken Russell's music works later in 2012. So.
Awesome.
Oh, and by the way, I never said that. Yes. This Saturday, Whippin', 12:32, me and Steve Bernal will trade off playing solo bass and solo cello pieces while you can come in and drink and eat some Indian food.
You know what Steve Bernal taught me in my journey of rock and roll? I'm still working on one. Steve Bernal taught me in my journey of rock and roll how to walk a bar tab. Even when the owner of the bar is chasing you through the parking lot screaming your name with the tab in his hand that you owe, to just pretend he's not doing it and keep on walking.
There you go, Hermano. See? There for the whole internet world to hear.
He's
more of your wisdom.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like, I told him that story, I think like last year or something, and I don't think at first he was like all about, oh, I never taught you. I was like, he insisted that if I went back and paid, which was my normal thing to do at that point, because I was scared I wasn't going to be able to work in places that I had outstanding tabs. But anyway, and you know what, I'm still friends with that bar owner too, so. I still walk his tabs.
For Steve telling stories like that, that thing is that a lot of his rather amazing and in-depth career, a lot of that for a long time was spent 300 days on the road.
Oh, yeah.
So he could do things like that.
That's when I knew him. That's when I got to know him.
He could do things like that. Those of us who are on the road somewhat more intermittently, and once again, also the funny thing, something we said before we actually started the official part of this interview, you can't do that. Those kind of things in the age of the internet and social media.
Yeah.
This person who played this concert in the city, this is what they just did. Look, and it's on their Facebook.
Yeah, you can't do any of that shit anymore. So is there anything else that you're up to that you want to talk about that we've missed?
Can we stop a second and I will smoke a cigarette and then we'll do that next part? Even as little as 10 years younger than us, much less way younger than us.
Yeah.
I tell them to watch Mad Men.
Think we'd see what smoking.
And I was like, that's when I was a little boy. That's you know you didn't ask you'd smoke in somebody's house. You didn't.
Yeah, everybody smoked. My grandma smoked.
Everyone smoked. Yeah. Everybody smoked, and it was I people who are not as manic addicts or experts in pop culture as I do, a lot of times I'll send them YouTubes of cigarette commercials because they never conceived of such a thing.
Commercial.
Like a cigarette commercial.
I like that. There's that thing, and I think it's almost in the first episode of Mad Men where they're grappling with being able to use the word, this is a healthy cigarette.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, using that as their campaign slogan. So what were you going to say you're working on this year?
This year, okay. What's coming up next? I am incredibly blessed. This is the first year and first season I've ever had three orchestra pieces at once. I have one in April, one in May, and one in June. And I'm working on all of them, but one is composed. But then it's to actually copy out the score and then get it to the publisher and proof it and have him. Can you wrap the rest of that up, please? Copy out and make the parts and all that stuff. That's a very involved process.
Right.
So I'm getting all those through the holidays.
Spear.
I haven't used mine, brother.
Oh, well, thanks.
Get all that worked on through the holidays. First, symphony starts back up again. Well, symphony's doing holiday things, but I'm not. I rotated out all that stuff.
Okay, so you can sub yourself out.
A lot of stuff is reduced orchestra, like Nutcracker, because of ballet budget and stuff, is only like two basses.
So wait a minute before we go too far with this. What about with all this stuff? How is the classical world doing, like ballets, symphonies, orchestras, things that I don't really, are they doing badly as well?
Oh, yes. People aren't. I mean, opera, oddly, is thriving.
Really?
Opera has found a way.
Maybe because it's so everyone's having such a bad time.
Such a bad time.
I think it's that opera has done a much better job of how to get people who thought, yes, I want to go to the opera, to be into enough of the spectacle.
Right.
Opera, in a way, is thriving. But symphonies and orchestras and budgets are in horrific shape. I mean,
so when you say they do a smaller orchestra for, like, the Nutcracker, how much smaller? Like, percentage-wise?
Oh, well, it's all the winds and brass, but in terms of string-wise, maybe two-thirds, maybe.
There's no winds and brass?
No, I said winds and brass play everything.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But maybe two-thirds, string-wise. Pops concerts are reduced. The kiddie concerts and the high school concerts, the stuff we play for, like, outreach for little kids and show a movie, and here's what classical music is, kids, whatever, that's maybe a third. And depending on your tenure level and where your rate in the orchestra is, you're not getting all this, are you? Are you sure about that? Oh, thank you.
I'm a guest.
Okay. Well, the next time I finally get a chance to get to one of your gigs, I'll reciprocate. So, that is less people. And some of it, you don't get offered at all because you're not in the rotation. Some of it, you're in the rotation, and you can say, do you want to do this? And I say no because it conflicts with my travel, or thankfully at that particular 2-week moment I don't desperately need the paycheck as badly as I might at other times, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So that's how that works. So anyway, I would say is that for subscription, I'm playing back again is the middle of January or early January. Please check austinsymphony.org. Don't have the exact date in front of me. austinsymphony.org to see when the next subscription stuff is. Then the next week is my 14th birthday in a row in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah. So you go there, you gamble?
Yes.
Yeah?
Like between 10 and 15 hours
a day.
Where
do you go in Vegas?
Oh, I have my places, but there are places, I go lots of places, but places I always go. Three places downtown. I always go to Cosmopolitan, which is a new place.
It's a new place. I went there.
I always go to the new Tropicana. The new Tropicana, or the redone Tropicana, is amazing. I may actually stay there this time. I'm not sure.
Cosmopolitan is that new. It's like a douchey kind of place.
Yeah, it is. It sure. See, and when they, I went when it was. I went Last year it had been open 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, I went there last January.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, we were there at the same time. Yeah.
They were trying to figure out what the target demo was. Like, it wasn't super douchey, and it's like, well, who is going to come here? And now they got, like, you know, three Las Vegas-y frat boy e-clubs that are open 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
But the thing that I can't really... Because a lot of my crew that goes with me have said, dude, we're not going there no more. I don't want to deal with that. But, number one, this is a funny thing. That's the most amazing smelling casino I've ever been
in. Yeah. I think it's because it's new.
Yeah. It just smells so good. And...
But you'd love that place. You can smoke everywhere there.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
No one can tell. I was walking by people smoking. You can't even tell people are smoking.
Yeah. That's why when I come back, every time I come back home from Vegas, it's almost reflex. Okay, we smoke everywhere again. Oh, no, this is real life again.
Yeah.
That bar inside that chandelier.
I didn't make it.
Cosmopolitan, did you not go?
I didn't make it into any of the cool places.
Okay, the world's biggest chandelier goes in the middle of that casino. And it's
always like the world's biggest something. It's the world's biggest Statue of Liberty made of jelly beans.
Exactly. It's five floors, I think. And it's got like eight levels. And you are actually a bar that actually has levels. You're actually inside a chandelier.
Awesome.
If you're interested to look at it, if you go back, in all of your spare time. If you go and look at, there's a Facebook album for every Vegas trip. If you look at last year's, there's pictures of it.
Of yours?
Yeah, and I just want to, I always want to make sure that even though I think I'm going to agree with everybody that place is really douchey and gross and I'm too old, no matter how much I try not to act my age, I'm too old to be in there, that I got to go in the big chandelier bar. I'm actually writing a piece about it.
That's awesome.
Because buddies of mine who are amazing musicians who used to work here, who I love very much, and I have a lot of really cool chamber things going on in New York. Oh, I should talk about New York before I'm done with this.
Yeah, talk about
too.
It.
One of their ensembles asked five new people to write them a piece, not definitively when it's going to be premiered, but for sometime in the next 6-18 months.
Uh-huh.
And that one of that particular buddies called me while I was inside that chandelier drinking during last year's Vegas, going, here's the thing, and blah, blah, blah. Will you write us a piece for this? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to write it about this.
Oh, yeah, so that's how you did it. Yeah.
And I started writing, scribbling, because there's sketchbooks with me incessantly. I write everywhere.
Do you write music down, like music notes? I can't do that.
Like everywhere. So I started writing right down there to a piece called Bars, Chandeliers, and Bars Inside
and
Chandeliers.
And you hear how it goes? Like it done. No, or whatever. Like, obviously, I shouldn't compose classical music because the first thing I just came up with was the worst thing anyone's ever heard.
No, that's not true. One of the bizarre things about the double-edged sword of why so many cliché classical music composers are crazy that write really fast like I do.
What do you think?
It's in your head 24/7. There is never music in a cable channel inside my brain all the time.
Right.
So at any given moment, you can go.
But it's also happening visually, because it happens to me too. But I mean, with me, it's like one of those 70s shows where there's a quote unquote rock band playing at the party. That band's always playing in my head. That's the first band that plays my songs I come up with.
No, but I mean,
and if it sounds good with them playing it, I know it's got to be kind
of
good.
And I do the visual thing too. Sometimes I'll see it on the page, and a lot of my bass music too. Of course, I don't write that way. A lot of my bass music I write with my bass in my hand.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, there was something I was just about to ask you to go, why did I lose it? How did I lose it? Okay,
we'll get it back.
Something.
Yeah. As my grandma says, it's important we'll remember.
Yeah, it's important we'll remember.
One other thing in the PK Productions umbrella that we're doing at least one more time the rest of season two is because of those people that I just mentioned having so much incredibly cool freelance different kind of chamber music going on in Manhattan. I have found this amazing space from this amazing lady that I barely have to pay anything. And we have a new series in this space.
And it's in Manhattan?
Called When Texas Meets Manhattan. Because all those particular buddies either used to work down here or went to school here, and I knew them. Now they do stuff in New York, and then I go there, and we all write new stuff or new stuff we're working on and mix all that together. And one of the huge blessings of surprises of last year was they have lots of stuff going. I know a lot of people in New York. They know lots of people they work with in New York. But again, you know, it's not like doing a concert here. I was going to be ecstatic to have 10 people, you know, because like, who's this?
Yeah.
And what? They're going to play what? And it's where?
Yeah.
Is in this sort of intimately, like sort of salon-y space. Kind of like how we're in a spot where they had concerts in the 18th century, like a big room in a building or someone's house or whatever. And it was all but standing room.
Wow.
Like there, if there had been two or three more people, they would have been out the door.
Awesome.
So, so doing that again. Yes.
You know
so,
when? You have a date?
We are actually one of my, mini constant never-ending email and phone list today is that since all of these people, as you well know, because you are too, all these people are also busy, we have one more set of emails and phone calls to go, okay, we can do this concert date. Okay, if we can do this concert date, can we have rehearsals on these two dates?
Right, so you have to kind of
like, once it's all situated, then you can
then
say,
you
then we're doing this.
Yeah.
Okay. Which because on that particular concert, so far, we'll be three brand new pieces, none of which I've written yet, but are sketched. And once we have it situated, then I need to write them.
Yeah.
Because the target for right now is that's end of February. So,
So I have one last question to go out on. Okay? And it was something you were just talking about. I got it back. Your grandma was right. It's important. As far as the crazy
and
the creative, which do you think comes first? Does the music make you mad, or are you suffering from madness and you find an outlet for it? Especially with classical people, because really I think the amount of shit going through your head.
Yeah. To be honest, I think it's kind of like, because I've given lots of talks about this through all of my therapies and mental health battles and loved ones, mental health battles.
I don't talk about it a lot.
I don't necessarily either, but I see no need to hide it or whatever. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is genetic. There's an enormous amount of instability on the dad's side of the family.
Okay.
But also, you add how bizarre my situation sort of was. You know, in a state not exactly known for intellectuals, even though there's a lot more smart
I can imagine your environment fucked you up where you were, and
deciding I'm going to be, well, not fucked you up in the
I'm going to be the weirdest guy. Not only am I the weirdest guy, I'm going to go and be weirder than who I was.
You know, not necessarily fucked up, but it's more like, sort of like people are like, that it was just, to say the least, unusual.
Right.
And then to take all this alleged brain power, and, oh, I'm going to be a classical musician for a living, and,
This is weird. And you know that's funny because it's funny because it's as far as about you, we met 22 years ago.
You know, I said 22 in my Facebook when I put my shoes on and got my keys. I realized I'd added it wrong, and then I put a comment under my Facebook going, "No, it's 24 years."
It's a long time.
Because I went to Rice 88 to 92.
Yeah, and that's when I met you.
Because
that's when Richard and Paul both started going. I knew them from there. When I met you then, I didn't forget you, but we weren't really very close.
No, yeah.
You know, you were people that we probably would have forgotten each other,
one bizarre thing about how my bizarre brain works, I remember everybody and their faces and what they were wearing.
Oh, wow. Oh, God.
Completely.
Forget what I was wearing.
Was it 1988? Well, we all were wearing that kind of, but, I am sort of the also cliched of the allegedly absent-minded genius because I work at home so much.
Right.
I spend a lot of time walking around my house trying to sing the next part of a piece I'm about to write down, looking for something that's in my hand. Or putting the remote controls in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Why is my watch in the microwave? So the thing is, people are like, you want to know what happened on a TV show or what so-and-so said at a party in 1978? Yeah. You don't care. I went to Cal's house and like he kept being really upset that he couldn't find a hat
that he was wearing.
Exactly.
Right,
so,
right.
but about
madness
your question,
comes first? I think madness.
I honestly think, from my viewpoint, it goes together. Now, yes, there are creative people who are unbalanced and don't have are going to their 28th year of therapy, and there are crazy people who can't draw a straight line or create anything. But I think, my humble estimation of that is that it's sort of things that kind of go together in some sort of automatic symbiosis.
Yeah.
Kind of like, let's to make an analogy, saying smoggy cities probably have lots of cars.
Yeah.
Okay, here's someone who's really creative and or really, really nuts. Well, you know what? They're probably both.
Yeah.
My answer is kind of like a both.
Right.
You know, because I don't... Because, honestly, you know, I always knew I was going to create things or be a musician or and write stories and write books or whatever. And then realized, you know, like, well, you know what? I'm more abnormal than I thought. And I would like to attempt to fix some of this. It would make my life and my loved ones not easier.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like you work out a lot of your personal shit in music? I mean, I do. I you know, I lean on my music a lot, like when I'm writing. Of course, mine has words too.
Exactly. I have an art song cycle. I don't have a whole lot of vocal music done. I have a cycle of songs all written about wine. That's going to be done by an old high school friend who is now a very prominent and accomplished opera singer next year. And I have a book of poetry coming out in 2013.
Oh, fantastic.
So, yes, in a sense, but not as in perhaps an immediate traceable sense, like someone like you. Here's a song I wrote about X.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily have nearly as many pieces or sonatas where I go, that sonata is about that.
Yeah.
I do have a lot that are,
right.
But it's not as automatically constant as I think for people who do what you do.
Right.
But, you know, if you just go in on, you know, my list of works and you look at my titles, it's like, you know, how many titles I have about betrayals. That's obviously about some, this piece is obviously about some shitty friend or shitty women or both. So,
yeah.
There is, but not to a sort of universal extent, I think, as what you people do.
You refer to me and my kind as you people. That's awesome.
You people. Literally, people who write. I have enormous. Because I did all that music, and I'm still a big music person of other things of what I.
Right.
Other than what I write.
And that's a misconception. I think sometimes people like me feel like people like you view us as lower than you.
Oh,
because,
no.
Because
mine, I think, is kind of the inverse. Because do you know how badly I tried for a little while? You know how badly I wish I could write a 3-minute song with 4 chords? I've tried.
I wish I could teach you.
I've tried my
it's a
damnedest.
Sub-genius thing.
And it ends up, it's too complicated. These phrases aren't even.
Right.
It always still ends up being too, like, arty. Not that there's not art vernacular music. You know, look at Jim Steinman, look at Yes, people. But you know, having so much country music in my blood and having it being still incessantly sacred to me, it seems like you.
Who do you go see? Like, when someone comes to town, who do you go when there's a concert coming? Who gets you out in rock and roll or country?
I very rarely have any time. Most 90% of every concert I ever see is when I go to Vegas.
Right. What do you see there?
I tried desperately last year to see Garth Brooks. I couldn't get tickets. I've seen Brooks and Dunn. Here's an interesting question that I'm asking a lot of other interviews. What's the most amazing non-classical concert of your life? 3 times in a row in Las Vegas, including once in the dead front row, was Tom Jones.
Oh, yeah.
That was
Tom Jones is coincidentally the reason why my father didn't pursue a career in music, because Tom Jones psyched him out. He was like, I'll never be that cool. My dad was very right.
Hi, Johnny's dad. I'm sure you're a cool person. Anyway, I'm sorry you're not as cool as Tom Jones.
If my dad even listened to any of these
but
podcasts
most people
and
are
actually
cool
made
Tom
it
Jones.
Through this far of one with the classical guy that
really?
I have on here with
some
the
weirdo with
the
a
symphony.
Hat and an earring and vampire pictures.
Then I would take whatever anger my dad had towards me if he actually made it this far.
But, yeah, and the most amazing thing, I was talking to a friend about this last night, about people who once were huge and, oh, you see the man and go, boy, that's sad. You know, that man is, I think, early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
He still sings everything in the original key. He holds all the notes. He still dances that way. He still is him.
I physically almost walked into him one night about 15 years ago at Steamboat.
Really?
On 6th Street. I was going to, I was out.
I think I had just fallen over dead.
And he had played at the Paramount that night. I guess just went over there, you know, see some music or something afterwards. He was just by himself leaning against the back bar. And I remember running, I was running through to go to the bathroom, and I was like running, and I passed, and I was like, Tom Jones is here. I turned around and I walked up and was like, Tom Jones? I think I walked up and was like, Tom Jones? And he went, yeah.
I was gonna say,
but then, like, what do I say? Like, oh, dude, let's call my dad.
Really?
I'm gonna be like, Dad, I call him Dad now. No, I'm joking. This is the most fucked up.
Well, and that's another thing is that Tom Jones gives this speech at the beginning and the end of his Vegas shows about, I was poor and I lived in Wales, and somebody told me I'd had any career, much less that he said, some of these songs are 40-some years old, and all of you are still here, and you care. He seems enormously humble,
I saw him. I saw him on that CBS Sunday morning show not very long ago, like 3 or 4 months ago, and same thing, just really down-to-earth dude.
And,
he's gotten laid more than any of us could ever imagine collectively. He's been doing it since before we were born, just banging.
That,
banging.
You know, the first time I got to see him, and because that song is so, I'm all about story songs. I always have been. Songs where you're like, you know, it's another miracle, I think, of songwriting. You tell me a novel or a soap opera worth of story in three choruses and two verses, and I'm sorry, many of my colleagues may scoff. To me, that is much of an achievement as writing Beethoven's Ninth.
Awesome.
That is.
Thank you.
The very first chord of Green Green Grass at Home.
Yeah.
Nobody else, even as much as they worship Tom Jones, knew that first chord. Like, I just knew that was that song. I just went into beyond hysteria. Yeah. To the point that the band is looking. What's up with that dude?
Tom Jones.
You know, and then the waterworks is just in.
Yeah.
And he actually, I think not the first time, but the second time I did that, he looked down and goes, hey, well, seems to be someone over here in this section who's a minor fan of that song, or else they've had some sort of organ failure. I don't know. I was like, oh, Tom Jones talking about me.
Wow.
So
Vegas.
Vegas. Oh, and you know, I want to say this right quick, too, because it mixes two things we talked about together.
Okay.
One reason that was such an amazing show, and one reason that means so much to me, my first ever memory of what Vegas is, when a little boy and see it on TV, what's Las Vegas? If anybody of a certain age is listening to this, in the late 60s to the early 70s, on Friday nights on ABC, Tom Jones used to have a TV show called This Is Tom Jones.
Yeah.
Every fourth week, it wasn't taped in the studio. Every fourth week, it was live.
In Vegas.
And it was in Vegas. And that's the first memory, other than the Merv Griffin show, of like, oh, that's what Las Vegas is. Boy, it looks fun there. I want to go. Now I go.
Now you go.
Minimal, twice a year. 2 years ago, I went 6 times. But.
Well, enjoy yourself. I hope you have a very happy birthday.
Oh, yes.
And thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank anybody who's listened to this and, point. And
look up Kel's stuff and P. Kellek Waddle.
Yes, P. Kellek Waddle. If you go to classicalmatters.com and classicalconnect.com.
And go see
is more crap about me than you would ever probably really want to read.
I found some of that.
And there are pieces and there are recordings and more recordings being added all the time. My publicity people, Wyatt Brand, David Wyatt at wyattbrand.com. My publisher, TFV Incorporated, run by Thomas B. Dawkins, thomasbdawkins@aol.com. Is that all the important links? Is anybody else going to be mad they didn't get mentioned? If so, I'm really, 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 really sorry.
All right. My friend Kelly Waddleman, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, brother.
All right, man. All right, so that was my conversation with Kelly. P. Kellek Waddle, my old friend from Houston. I hope you enjoyed it. I did too. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this at the top, but we were eating at the South Congress Cafe. I had the
crab cakes, and he had the Eggs Benedict with crab cakes. I'd like to thank Kelly for coming out. I'm really glad we got to have that conversation. I'm looking for all kinds of music, man, all the time. Our new producer, Jessica Jarrett, is out there looking for us. So I guess we'll post an email address for you guys to write to find out if you want to get on, or if you're a publicist, you have an artist that wants to get on. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for Kelly for meeting me. And here's one of Kelly's original compositions for bass.